Well, I think it's time to begin. My name is Sammy Mayer, and I'd like to tell a funny little story about that before I go on. Two people already, Karen and, what's your name again?
Susan
asked me what my name was, and I said, well, I am known as Sammy Mayer. And they said, oh, Nona Sammy. And it was funny that two people, so I just decided I wouldn't use that expression anymore. My real name is Selma, but I have been known as Sammy since my high school days, and I still go by that. My topic for the entire week, the overarching topic, is going to be Two Homes of I. And I admit to having stolen that from my daughter Marie, who was a senior in high school, and wrote an essay after she came back from India, for which she won a senior student award for Prom Magazine. So I thought it must be a pretty good topic. And trying also to zero in on the fact that India has profoundly affected me, and that I really do have two homes within my spirit and my heart and my mind. So I thought that that would be a good topic. But before I unpack any more of that, let's pray. Tharti, tharti, nitkirein. Tharti, tharti, nitkirein. O pavi kadavaitera. Tharti, tharti, nitkirein. That little Tamil prayer is something that we taught to the children, and I thought it's very appropriate. It's Christ standing at the door and saying, O sinner, I'm standing at the door, please open so that I can come in. And I think we've been talking about that a lot in our cross-cultural reflections, openness. We need to be open, not only to the Christ, but to one another, who are little Christs among us. I want to say just a little bit about myself. this year is really a leave of absence for me. This is my only commitment for the year, which Jody hooked me into last fall. But I have been the national coordinator for AELC Women for the last 9 years. And have had a lot to do with the planning of the new women's organization and the new commission for women of the new church. So I wear that hat as well. I have really been working on a women's movement for a long time. But today I want to wear the hat of having spent 17 years in India with my husband Jim, who died 4 years ago and was area secretary for Southeast Asia for the Missouri Synod, and a country in which all of my 8 children, 7 were born there. My eldest daughter, Marie, who is here, was 3 months old when we went there. So it's also her home. So that experience was one that I want to share with you, not in terms of my work. I've been back from India now a little more than 20 years. And so I feel a little bit hesitant even to reflect on it. But there are some very key reactions that I remember and very key infections from India that have stayed with me till this day. And I thought that it would be very helpful for me to share those with you and translate that into our own ministries here, where we are continually experiencing schizophrenia in terms of our neighborhoods, our workplace, gender, age, but I think most probably to the greatest extent in crossing cultural boundaries. We experience a schizophrenia, and we don't know often what to do with that. It is either immobilizing or it moves us into constructive engagement and helps us to grow. And that's why I came to the theme for this day of healthy schizophrenia. And that is for us to kind of ferret out today. All of my topics for this week are going to be under the theme, really, of Two Homes Have I. I hope to relate all the topics to my India experience in some way. And I would like to say that I brought some of the beauty of India with me to help create a little bit of an atmosphere for you. The pictures of the gods that you see would be something that you would see if you would enter a coffee shop. They would have them under glass all around the little coffee shop. And among them, and I wasn't sure where to find that here, and I didn't want to drag it from home, would be a picture of Jesus. So that it reflects the whole Hindu philosophy that all philosophies are legitimate and that all gods are prophets. And so we would always see the Christ among the gods of India. And I thought I'd kind of recast that for you. And also the clothing, there are many different kinds here. This one here is really a Parsi. You can come and look at it after a while. But just the various shades. You know, when you would sit in a congregation in India, and all of the women would be sitting on the floor. They always divided the men and the women. And the women would be sitting on the floor. And the sari was so wonderfully versatile. They would never come in without covering their head. So they simply took the sari and covered the head. And if they were pregnant, they left out another fold. And so that their sari became their maternity outfit as well. But the shades and the colors with flowers in their hair was a beauty that has stayed with me to this day. But I want to talk to you about myself and about some of the dynamics that went on in me. And then I want you to talk about yourself so that we don't always just talk about things, but that we can somehow assimilate what we're hearing into our experience and then maybe move into some steps for action. So I would like to do that. First of all, I did put a map here, and in case some of you may not know, this is where we served in India, at the very, very tip of India. We were at that time part of the Missouri Synod, and we served between Bangalore and Madras. They had most of their stations. We were stationed 400 miles up from the Cape. And this work in this area was mostly ALC and LCA. And we lived in the Tamil-speaking area. And the little song that I sang to you was in Tamil. Others, there are 400 languages in India. And so I thought just to give you a taste of one of them. My husband was a clergyman, went to Concordia Seminary, and I, as a young girl, already aspired to be a missionary. My mother was a neighborhood missionary. She would go throughout the neighborhood during the week and rap on doors and ask people why they weren't in church and why they were painting their houses instead. And I think that she inspired a very special zeal in me that stayed with me. And so I was very surprised when I met Jim that he also wanted to go into foreign work. And as it happened, we were called to India. We married and went to mission school for a year. And I learned a bit of Sanskrit. And we did all of the histories of missionaries. And we're supposed to be prepared. And I was very happy because it was something I had wanted to do all my life. And I think in Lutheran circles, to be called as a missionary was probably the ultimate, you know, the ultimate that one could reach in terms of roles, of religious roles, you know. This was wonderful. And so I was 23 at the time, and I had a little baby of 3 months old. So even though I was very happy, I was terrified of going into a whole new situation and a new culture. But then I remembered the promises of God, that God would be with me, and that whatever I met, I was a pretty together person. I had incredible credentials. In terms of myself, I was from a very good family, 5 generations of teachers and pastors. I belonged to the Missouri Synod, the Church of the True Doctrine. I was also white. I was from the U.S., the most powerful nation in the world. And I just went with a lot of confidence in my credentials. And in the promises of God, too. But my credentials meant a great deal to me. So we set out on the Borneo, which was a cargo ship, with 32 other missionaries, United Methodist and Baptist and Presbyterians, and you know, for a Missouri Synod, 23-year-old boy, this was rubbing shoulders with the wrong side of the track, so to speak. So that was probably my very first introduction to a kind of schizophrenia that I had to deal with. And we went around the Horn of Africa, went through the Mediterranean. The bluest water that I have seen before I came to Holden. And we stopped off in Egypt. And it was our first taste of a third world country. And it was scary, but you know, we could always get back on the ship again. And so we proceeded, and it took us about 2 weeks before we arrived in Karachi, which is the port in the northernmost part of India. It's really in Pakistan. And it had been blistering hot on the ship. The Dutch crew had been most solicitous. What was a kind of ship that had no sides to it. It had only railings. And so the ocean was right within 100 feet down, and there were little two-year-olds running around on halters. All the parents had them on halters so that they wouldn't fall overboard. And I was always grateful that my child was in the bed at 3 months old. But when we arrived at Karachi, it was our first glimpse of our new culture. And I think that at the moment that I looked over the rail, all my senses came alive. There were sounds that I had never heard before. Mm-hmm. Women screaming at each other. There were sights that I did not think existed. Mothers cleaning the heads of their children and asking for alms. Cooking food on the port right next to the ship. The smells were abhorrent to me. And the only thing I had left was my touch. And so we thought we would be very brave and take a gherry, which is a horse-drawn carriage in our, sometimes you have in my hotels. This was carried by a camel. And the camel had worn off spots across its entire body and stank like unbelievable old well water. And as we jogged through the city, there were men and women doing their natural functions along the walls of the city. And I immediately withdrew into myself and felt how uncivilized. And is this the country that will be my home for 7 years? That was our term in those days. And then the realization came that I would have to learn to speak again, that I did not have the ability to get down from the gherry, and after all, I had come there to win souls for Christ. I would not have been able to get down from the gharry and speak to anyone and ask them if they knew the Jesus whom I knew. And then I realized only in later years, if I even could have done that, that they would have responded, "Of course we know your Jesus." And I would have been left speechless because of interpretation of that. So we must have gone around the city for about an hour. And I came back to the ship. And I flung myself on my bunk and I wept bitterly. And I don't think it was so much what I saw, because I think one can always block out those sights that are so foreign to a person. But I think it was that my credentials were gone. All my credentials were gone. I couldn't speak. I couldn't think like they did. Who cared if I came from the Missouri Synod? And who cared if my family was very Orthodox? And they hated the U.S. It was right after independence. So I was vulnerable. And I think it was the first time in my entire life that I felt like a cipher. And I think that it was, as I reflect and remember, one doesn't always assimilate this at the moment. My first reaction was, I wish I could take the next boat home. But as I think back on that, that was the moment of my liberation, was the moment that my credentials were taken from me. Now, there were three ways, I think, that one of the reasons, I think, that I was in such turmoil was that I had a schizophrenia about my identity. I was number one. I came with that identity. But I was no longer number one coming out of the U.S. My relationship to other people, which was usually kind and gentle, was suddenly fearful and unprotected and unknown. And my perception of the world suddenly exploded, so that I was in a schizophrenic position. And that position could have destroyed me, or it could have brought me health. And I think that as I think about our years in India, and I think about the missionary communities there, and the Americans that served in industries and came over as business people, dealt with it in different ways. One can either build walls around oneself and recreate your own U.S. communities, which a lot of people did. Who was going to hobnob with the natives? No way. And who was going to let the natives through the doors of the walls? So that these isolated U.S. communities were spotted throughout the country, particularly in the large cities. We studied language in Bangalore for a year. It was a large city. There were all the U.S. clubs, which are not bad. I think people need a place to recoup themselves and see their own kind again. Madras, full of clubs, of British clubs, and the Punes walking around in service to them. But I feel that as a missionary community, and there were about 32 of us there, that many of us chose a way of opening ourselves in vulnerability to a new culture. And that very powerlessness which I felt in the very beginning was not ever fully replaced. So I dealt with that situation. I believe that, first of all, I was a Westerner there, and I think we did have a certain status. But I feel that I dealt with the situation, and that my husband, we made the effort to open ourselves to the Indian community. Our children went to foreign schools. They had to go 400 miles into the mountains. Both Marie and my son Ted attended. Marie attended there for almost 12 years. So that was a kind of recreating your own community again. And yet we were again in a schizophrenic position, because if they were to go home and fit into the college situation, what would they do with the Indian education, which was very good? But we had to make some decisions about what to do with our children. And so Cody Connell had a boarding school, and it had a grade school, and the interdenominational high school and grade school was right across the way. And we did not hobnob with them either in those early years. We needed to have our own kind of Missouri Synod hill at which our children were educated. And that was something which I think had its negatives and positives, because they were indeed in India. But as we were coming up the hill here and going around the bends and looking down the cliffs, it reminded us of India and how we used to have to go to visit the children on our leave. And they boarded there. We didn't see them for 9 months of the year. So, you know, those were all decisions that we had to make. Were we willing to give up the raising of our children from 6 and a half until 18 so that we could do the Lord's work? That was my situation. And I believe that all of us go through those kind of encounters in our very own turf. And I wonder if we could just for a moment, we want to do two things now. And one of them is for you to identify some of the cultural characteristics of U.S. citizens. Yeah, you know, in any kind of work, this is a little pamphlet that I got a hold of that is extremely interesting. It was put out for exchange students to help them so that they wouldn't be the ugly American when they went overseas. But it was very instructive for me to see what are some of the characteristics of North American people, or particularly U.S. people, in inhibiting them of entering and creating an interdependent world. And I think it could be something for us to look at just for a few minutes. They say that there are three things that contribute toward how societies see one another. One of those is how we identify ourselves. One of those is how we see our relationship to other people. And the other is how we perceive the world. And we could go from culture to culture to culture and find that not one of them sees the world like we do. So that it's sort of important to identify again how we see ourselves. And could I have just a few? We just don't want to do too much of this, because I want to do something else with you. How would you identify yourself as a U.S. person coming from the U.S.?
Highly individualistic.
Highly individualistic.
Competitive.
Would you, as a follow-up to that, tons of rain dry here. Uh, As a follow-up to that, how could that prevent our integration into an interdependent world? I don't know who made the comment. Yes.
You know, it probably comes from a scarcity principle. You know, we promote our own kind.
Okay.
And there's only so much to go around. And if we don't get it, then right. Somebody else will get it.
Okay.
It's also part of the pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps mentality. You don't need anybody else if you can do that.
Right. Would you say, is that achievement-oriented or success or independent. Good word.
American independent.
That we pull ourselves up for our bootstraps. How is that different from other societies that you know about or that you've heard about?
A lot of the developing nations are very dependent.
Very dependent. They depend not only on family, but they depend on the whole clan. The entire community, the whole caste. And we talked in the Bible study about the social security of having many, many children. I've known of families with 16 children with 3 survivors, but they had that many so that they could have the 3 who would care for them in old age. So the dependence is incredible. Another one.
A sense of rightness. I mean, America.
Okay, that,
really
that we think. Sort of have it, we know it, and we have it to give.
Right.
Kind of that we can tell other people how to do things.
Know-it-alls.
Okay.
Kind of conceded that.
Yeah, the truth, yeah.
We have the truth.
All right, and that we have the truth. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I've noticed, too, whenever I've traveled abroad, that Americans give the feeling that we are civilized and the rest of the world is uncivilized. You pointed that out. Anything that is different is considered uncivilized to Americans.
Okay. All right.
The superiority of English language.
Okay, and the language superiority. Right. That our language really tells it all. Yeah. Let's just take one more.
Our religious worldview that we come from.
Our religious, are you the one that, oh, yes.
Religious worldview.
Our religious worldview, yes. Uh-huh. That all the others are pagans, and then that we label them as less of humanity than we are. Religious.
Okay. Well, that's the missionary concept.
That's right.
Go out.
We're going to deal with that a little bit tomorrow. Mm-hmm. How we deal with them as the dark continent.
Values, thinking. We think our logic system, our values are really what's important, and nothing else makes sense.
Okay. and so that when we move into other cultures, we really feel that we're bringing this gift to other people. We don't see ourselves as inhibiting our growth or inhibiting them from being truly themselves. We truly feel that these are all gifts. And in a sense, they can be. They can be. But I think it's good for us to raise the caution about ourselves. The thing that I would like to do, though, we have a half an hour, and we were given kind of instructions, you know, don't talk too much, half an hour talk and half an hour participation. So I'm just wondering, and I think it would be helpful, if we would go around the room and as many people as possible would answer this question, and I think I should read it because it's important. Can you remember a time when you were faced with a person or a people with a difference that made you feel afraid, powerless, incompetent, clumsy. And how did you deal with that? What did you do? I'd like to start off, I already told my story about India and how I handled it. I cried my eyes out, I knew that I couldn't go back on the next ship, and I did move into a listening and a learning mode. But then I've been at meetings where I've met a lesbian woman for the first time in my life and was just totally tongue-tied. And I felt incompetent because I didn't know her as a woman. I didn't have the information, and I had all the bad information. And I remember that as a time when I felt extremely clumsy. Those are the kinds of things, and I'm sure we must have hundreds of stories like that, where you have either crossed a cultural boundary or have met someone very different that evoked those kinds of feelings in you. And I'd like everybody to participate, and so let's start somewhere.
I'll tell you one. I was in New Guinea for 2 years and as a teacher at a Lutheran school. And right after I got there, so I wasn't really very clued in on things yet. At the boarding high school where I taught. And the whole thing centered around the fact that one of the girls who was taking her rostered job of cooking had her period. And the boys struck, you know, and said, this is it, we're not going to eat. And my immediate reaction was, well, let them starve. and instead, what had to happen was about a two-day long meeting in which we went through all kinds of stuff about, I mean, I just sat there and learned a lot, because it wasn't so simple as to say the boys can't do this, and the girls, it wasn't the girls' fault, and you'll find out that you won't be in danger of losing your fertility by eating this food. I mean, it was a long process, and I was just amazed.
How long did you hang in there with that?
With that.
With the process, yes.
Oh, well, I think I learned a lot. I think that the meeting went on for about 2 days, and they had all the student leaders and everything, and there was a lot of one of the things that I learned very much was that the New Guinea tribal system is terribly democratic. Everybody gets a say, and you talk it out until consensus is reached. That's an amazing process, and time doesn't enter in as a factor. They don't say, well, you know, we have to finish this meeting in another 5 minutes, and therefore we're going to take a vote and the majority win. No. I mean, it's mm-hmm. talked until it's all out, and everybody's in agreement. I wish I could remember more of the details of how of the process, because I was really new. Later on, I mean, I can sort of remember that I thought I had it all figured out, I thought, in 6 months, and then the whole thing fell apart again.
Okay, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Back in 1969 in high school, I became very close friends with a black girl, and it was, you know, during the times when you really did not make friendships like that, but it was, I don't quite even remember how it started, but very different background. She was away from home. She had come out to I grew up in a family that was very, very stable, went to church every Sunday, and, you know, didn't really have much need to step out. Well, she'd come to the West Coast with her brother's wife to help when he was in the service, to help take care of the baby. She found out that she instead she could not go back to Connecticut because she couldn't graduate from high school because she was short an English credit. So she lived with a foster family. I never even heard about foster families. And I think I wanted her. I was working at a local department store, and I asked through the acquaintance. I just asked her to model for me for a fashion show. So I would have. If we were predominantly a white school, but I thought, well, I wanted to have a mixture of people, a cross of people. I didn't understand even at that time doing, now we're having certain percentages of multicultural people on different boards. And she could not, she was supposed to go to a funeral down in California with this foster family. She didn't want to go. So I says, well, why don't you just come stay at my house? Not really thinking that she would come stay, but I still offered that, to have her do that. Well, she came to stay with us. And it was the start of this wonderful friendship. Well, a week after graduation, she left and went back to Connecticut. And we corresponded over the years for 17 years. And then she came back with her family. And now we have a wonderful family friendship. And I mean, we knew after 17 years, it was like we picked up right where we stopped. We had no idea. It was kind of a scary situation bringing our families together. We did not know. We knew we'd have a great time, but we didn't know if our families would get along. And they got along wonderful. And now now it's something that we go back and forth. They were holding with us last summer for the rainbow. It was kind of extending the invitation out. I don't know if they probably wouldn't have come to Holden with us had it not been for the rainbow celebration. Anyway, so I was just kind of making a step, not realizing even then where it would take me. Mm-hmm. And we feel like, even in very, very differences in backgrounds, but still very, very close. It's kind of frigid where you go. It goes beyond the external.
Right, so you took a step where you could easily be infected by her culture,
mm-hmm.
by having her with you. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm ashamed to tell this story, but I will because it's been part of my growth. When I first came to the States, I didn't really know much about black people except what I had heard. And my dad and my mom both had really broad, I felt, attitudes towards different people. But when I came to the States, I felt like I wanted to get to know other cultures. I felt very much out of place here, first of all, in the U.S. And I don't remember what year that was, but it was a march, some kind of a march commemorating Martin Luther King. And my sister and I walked a very long walk. There was crowds of people. This was in St. Louis. And a couple of young black men were walking beside us. And they were talking to us, and we were terrified. We refused to talk to them. And here we were marching. It was a very significant march, but we knew nothing about black people or their struggle. We really didn't. I mean, we knew just in our heads what it was about, and we couldn't bring ourselves to talk to these people because we were afraid. I don't even know what we were afraid of. And even after that, there were many instances where I was afraid. I don't know why. I think maybe I was afraid of them saying something to me that I would feel hurt. But I do remember many times when I took a different path and I saw black people coming forth. I have to admit it's taken many years. My children are part black. And even then, I have to acknowledge the deep rootedness of these feelings, that even I had to overcome.
In spite of the fact that you grew up in another culture.
Yeah. And then on the other side of that fear, when I first met Will Hertzfeldt and Pete Peril, Pete who was here earlier, and they came to our home, that was the beginning of real nurturing understanding. And as soon as we walked in the door, they had their arms open. And there was no way you could
come. So they saved us. So we can take different ways of dealing with that. Either run away or open our shirts and our hearts to accept the arrows and to accept those differences. And I think it's for us to see which of those ways is the healthy way, which will lead to that interdependent community of God's creation that we so long for. Is it that controlling way, or is it to reach out your hands? My husband always had a wonderful story. It's not really a story, but a model that he talked about. And he said that when you're on the top of the mountain, the only way to protect yourself is to hold your ass from all those coming up behind you. But he said, and when you're doing that, you don't have anything, any hands to reach out to other people. It was all, do you remember that, Joe? It was always a great, great story of his. Yeah. Let's hear some others. Yes.
I spent a month in West Africa in Sierra Leone, and I was about 4 years ago, I guess, and I was so struck when I first arrived with just the teeming mass of people that just walk the streets any time, day or night, just in the streets. And it was overwhelming to me, exciting, but overwhelming, just, you know, very few cars, everybody's walking everywhere. And very quickly we landed, we're kind of taken here and there. The next thing I know is in a car being rushed up country and plopped in a family's home. One of the local ministers of the Sierra Leonean church, and put me in a guest house. And I was all by myself in this guest house with all the different kinds of smells and sounds, and really thinking, gosh, here I am, so far away from home, and I hadn't had a chance to really even see the country yet or meet many people, and I was just kind of overwhelmed. And before I knew it, I heard the door open, and the woman and her daughter came into the house, and was difficult because her English was not real great, and I certainly didn't speak her language. But she expressed to me that when guests arrive, that they know that the guests can be afraid, and so that they slept in the guest house with me, not in my same room, but they slept in the guest house with me so that I wouldn't be afraid. And I was so struck with, I was like, I didn't want to admit that I was afraid. I'm a grown-up woman, you know, I'm going to be afraid. But I was afraid, and it was so neat. And we couldn't talk with each other, and they just went into their room and went to sleep. But just knowing they were there was such a lovely thing, and I've never forgotten that gesture. And I still felt afraid, but they were there, and I sat in my room writing in my journal and describing the sounds and the smells, and, you know, and it happened. It was really a nice gift.
Okay. Yes,
Holly? When I was 19, I was privileged to be a part of a study team, a group of college students that went to Iran for 6 months. And when we arrived there, we had 1 month of a homestay to live with a family and to learn the language and to kind of assimilate ourselves, and then we moved to another city for an academic stay where we would have classes at the university. When I arrived, my homestay had a daughter my age, my homestay family had a daughter my age who had been an AFS student for a year in Minnesota. So it was real comfortable for me. I mean, it was awkward, but it was real comfortable. I had someone to interpret to me and who would understand the kinds of things that I had experienced and to make that transition. But when we moved to our academic stay, I was assigned to live with a family by myself again, but who did not have that ability to interpret because they didn't know anything about my culture, and I found that I really didn't know anything about theirs in only a month, and I was terrified. I was given a room with a curtain across the door and a pad on the floor to sleep on, and they had a three-year-old who kept riding her tricycle through the curtain, and it terrified me that I would have no privacy and no vehicle to communicate or to understand, and I was living in this family. I also recognized that they were fairly wealthy by Iranian standards because they did have a refrigerator, which stood prominently in the living room because it was, you know, a status symbol. And I just cried. I cried and cried and cried and cried for 2 days, and they put me in another house where one of the sons spoke German and had gone to college in Germany, and I could communicate with him. but, you know, looking back, I just see how much I had lost out on by being so distraught.
Well, I think that you're being distraught also is a part of, I feel, always a part of the liberation, because sometimes that's the only way through it. That those are also gifts to us, that we can be distraught, but how do we deal with that? You know, do we let that close ourselves off then from those new and just revolutionary experiences in our lives? And we all have them in one form or another. We do have them.
By the end of my stay, I found that I got along much better with the Persian students than I did with the American students, and found myself going off with them to families and to have dinner with them, and as opposed to being with the American students in that 6 months. But right there at the beginning, it was terrible.
We've heard a lot of third world kind of experiences, but what about here in the States? Anybody have? Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Here, yeah.
Mine wasn't going to be a third world. My mother is legally blind, and my brother was in the service in Germany, and he got sick all of a sudden. And one lung had collapsed, and the other one was in the process of collapsing. And so the United States Army thought he was going to really die. So they sent my mom, and because she was blind, I had to escort her. So we went to Germany. Like one day we weren't going. The next day they got passports, emergency passports. And I always thought of other people as being foreigners, not of myself as being a foreigner. I mean, I knew of being black and different than not being foreign and black. And we went to Germany, and we still talk about when we got there. He really looked bad. I mean, there were tubes running every direction, and he was in semi-consciousness. But he knew my mom was there. He knew I was there, and like he made a turn the next day. So we stayed 8 weeks there. And the first time I went to town, I forgot the translation book, and I had to I always have to go to the bathroom. So I asked them if speaking in English, and the lady says nine, and I says, you got a bathroom, lavatory, restroom, and I was buying some gloves, some leather gloves, so I pointed, you know, I pointed gloves and that, and I had to go bad, and I was bouncing. And she looked at me and she says, I'm toilet. So, what I found out though was sign language is really international.
There you go.
And that the maids that came into the army base would clean our room and that, and we got so that we could talk to them. They didn't speak English and I didn't speak German, but we sign language, so many things. And they thought we were rich because of the things that we have. I mean, what we live, what our people have here on welfare, we would be very rich over there. And the wash machines or little like toy wash machines and stoves, and how they would buy food from one day to the next and that. But we sign language to everything, and so it was the first time I experienced being a foreigner, and that was an unusual feeling because I always think of other people as being foreigners, not as myself as a foreigner.
Thanks for that, Janet. Yes, I saw some hands over here.
Yeah, my wife and I.
You and I went to Maryland to go to church.
My wife and I were interim managers of a Bible camp 5 years ago on the White Earth Indian Reservation in northern Minnesota. And this is an area of land dispute, where which clouds the issue is that even a person who is 1/8 Native American can claim rights to this. It's kind of like me saying I'm a Swede, even though only 1/8 of my ancestry is such. And there's a mess of political parties within a reservation. You know, you can't just say this is the Native American viewpoint, because their tribal elections are serious business there, and at least 4 or 5 candidates, you know, within a 500 to 700 voter assembly, you know, are running, each with distinct views. It was during tribal election time, it was during a powwow, and groups of people, some quite potentially, you know, quite outraged over the situation, wanted that land back right now. Group wanted to have a picnic on the beach that the camp, quote, owns. And camp was going to have a program there at the same time, and I had to confront an individual who set up his barbecue grill, which was just a wheel taken off of a truck. You know, and he was twice my size, wore mirror sunglasses. I'll never forget that. I could not see his eyes. Very husky, about 6'4", 250 pounds.
Missing some teeth.
So I knew he was on that probably. You know, I mean, it was not afraid. I didn't think he was afraid of me. You know? But I was afraid of him and the situation, because deep down inside, you know.
But you treated her as a person by confronting her. You see, I think that that's sometimes what we do as people, is that our fear of not being understood prevents us from a confrontation, from a possible confrontation, which really leads to healing and understanding and all of that. And I feel that you did treat her as a person. And, you know, and that's often the problem in the India context, is where the outcast people, particularly, are sort of patronized. They are patronized rather than really confronting them with how the psychological, the whole system has just, every time they pop their head up, they're pushed down. And that in Christ, that doesn't have to happen, you know, and to confront them with that. And I know that some missionaries who did that were very much blamed. They said, well, how are you treating, look how you're talking to these people. We were treating them as persons. And you know, that's another whole side of that. Okay, let's take one more. Yes.
I was thinking, I'm from a small town, Washington State, and moved to Washington, D.C. for the last 5 years, and I feel like I've got all kinds of these things going on. But my feelings that I was sitting here thinking are the same as when I was 16 years old and my high school Spanish class went to Guadalajara, Mexico. And we traveled generally in a group of 20. We might split off into two groups of 10. And I remember how exciting it was when we were in our group of 10 and maybe we interacted with the Mexicans somehow. I mean, maybe it was just the Mexican waitress or waiter that we had a little bit of conversation with and found out a little bit about their lives. You know, that was just an exhilarating experience. But then I can remember also when this group of 10 became, I don't know if I got off by myself or if there were two people, but we were at this park and all of a sudden we were the minority and, you know, it was all Mexicans and us. And that was a very different experience for me. Then I was just full of fear, wanted to look tough, but just really wanted to get out of that situation where I felt so vulnerable, but you know, I was just such a distinct minority. And I think my experiences in D.C. are the same, that, you know, I can really feel open and, you know, just really enriched by interaction if I'm safe, not the only one like me, you know, if I'm more like people with me. But if I get off in a section of the city where I feel very different and much in the minority, then I'm again, you know, fearful and I just want to escape that.
I think that, yes, that kind of puts it in a nutshell. I think that our fears in meeting people that are very different from us in any way, they tend to make us make ourselves secure. We want to do something to make ourselves secure. And if I could leave anything with you, that would be that your vulnerability and your powerlessness is a gift. Don't deny that. Don't run away from that. Open yourselves to other people and learn also from them. And be good listeners. And those learnings will lend themselves to your growth and to your enrichment. And I know how terrified people are when suddenly another cultured people moves into their neighborhoods. You know, my goodness, we're going to have our whole neighborhood blown up. You know, those are very normal reactions for us. We are not comfortable. That's okay not to be comfortable. But don't go in your house and lock the door. Keep the door open so that you may be infected and that you in turn can infect the other people with whom you're dealing. I thank you very much for sharing that with us. And